When you visit California Wine Country, spending time on Spring Mountain will introduce you to some of the most interesting wineries in the area, with some spectacular views. Spring Mountain rises above the town of St. Helena at the north end of Napa Valley. We've already done one interview from the area, and there are several more to come. This time, we met with Sam Baxter, winemaker at Terra Valentine. Sam grew up in the wine business and is one of the very few winemakers that can say he works 2,000 feet up on Spring Mountain in a castle.
First of all, what brought you into the wine business?
Well, I was born into the wine business to a certain extent. My father, Phil Baxter, moved up to Napa in 1968 and started working for Charles Krug Winery. And he was a recent graduate of Fresno State, and they were really recruiting winemakers at that time. So he began his career here and started a family. And so I was born in the mid-70s in St. Helena. Spent my childhood running around the winery, following him through the vineyards and through the cellar, and drank a lot of grape juice. And it just started to kind of ingrain this passion in me for the lifestyle, the winemaking, the grape growing, the life of a farmer slash winemaker.
So you grew up in St. Helena?
Born and raised, yes.
What a great place to grow up.
It was a great place to grow up, and I still think it's a great place to live and to raise a family, and I have two kids of my own now that are doing having a similar lifestyle to what I grew up with in the vineyard and the winery.
1968, there wasn't a whole heck of a lot going on yet. The ball was just starting to roll here.
It was. I think at that time there were maybe a dozen or maybe 20 wineries getting going. But, you know, Robert Mondavi had just split from his brother and was starting Robert Mondavi Winery. There was still a train that came up and to Charles Krug, and that's how they shipped their wine out. They would load up the boxcars. So it was definitely a much slower pace. It was still maybe more walnuts and prunes than grapevines at that time. They were really farmers. I mean, we were hardworking people that were struggling to, you know, to make a living on the wine business.
Back to you, where did you end up going to school?
I went to University of California at Davis. Partly I had to one-up my dad, who went to Fresno State, so I had to do something a little different. And, you know, at the time, it's, and I think it still is, you know, the best school for winemaking in this country. And it's an institution that's really research-based. I mean, they do an incredible amount of research into wine, but there is a practical aspect to it as well. And it's also just the college experience. And so I definitely was not the best student in college, but I learned quite a bit. And I studied life as well, which I think was important.
That's pretty broad.
Yeah.
You finished college, and you're still, you know, basically right here in California. Did you plan on being a winemaker? Was it still somewhat open to you?
It was kind of my contingency plan. I knew that going to UC Davis and studying wine, I could certainly make my way into the wine business. I also was kind of distracted by beer for a couple of years and studied brewing science at UC Davis as well, with the thought that I might like to dabble in the brewing industry. You know, later, you know, probably about my junior or senior year, it really kind of came home to me that how interesting wine is compared to beer. Beer, like cooking, which I love as well, is somewhat recipe based, and you get your raw ingredients and you make a recipe, and if it doesn't turn out great, you can dump it. And wine, you have one chance of vintage to make wine, and you're growing the grapes. It's a much more rewarding experience. And so I knew at that time, towards the end of college, that it, you know, wine was definitely my future.
So where did you end up? Where was your first stop?
Well, it's kind of ironic, but because of how small Terra Valentine is, my dad said that I really ought to get the experience of working at a large winery, just to see how a large winery works. And so I took his advice and went to work at Sterling Vineyards in the harvest of 1998. And really quickly learned that the large winery setting was not for me. Just much more of an artist than a production manager or a scientist. And so it's that size of facility makes it very tough for someone to really get into all aspects of the wine and the real artistic side of things. So at that point as well, I was right out of school and worked the harvest and was finishing up with that and was really kind of at a crossroads, and I wasn't sure if Napa Valley was where I really wanted to land. It had changed so much from when I had grown up. in high school to, you know, going off to school, even though it wasn't that many years, but coming back and getting into the wine business, I realized how much it had changed since I had really been involved with my dad in the wine business growing up. And so I was a little bit disenchanted and decided I needed to travel and you know, just get a kind of a little bit more experience and a little bit more exposure to the wine industry. And so I traveled down to Australia in the spring of 1999 to work a vintage in Victoria, which is the winery that I worked at was called Taltarney Vineyards. And Taltarney at the time had been solely French run up until the 99 vintage. And everything they did there was really like working in a winery in France. I mean, the same fittings, all the techniques that they used were brought over by the Porte. Dominique Porte had been managing the company for, I think, 10 or 15 years. And the vintage I went over with Chris Markel, who had been at Piper Sonoma, worked in Burgundy for a number of years, but it was California Davis trained, and we brought over some new lab equipment. And really, I was kind of seeing the beginning of this transition from old world techniques to kind of bringing a little more science to it, running a little more analysis, kind of updating what they had been doing. And not that they were doing anything wrong, but it was just bringing a fresh perspective to it. And so it was really interesting to see that. But I'd say what I enjoyed the most about it was getting down in the cellar and working with these guys that had been there for, you know, their whole career in that small town. Everyone knew each other. They were all growing grapes, sharing information, and seeing the passion and the lifestyle that all of these people had, that how happy they were to be just living and breathing the vines, the work, the dinners, the drinking afterwards, just that everything revolved around the wine industry there. And it was a tiny, tiny little area. And I guess seeing that connection and that spirit that was involved in the winemaking there kind of, I guess, refreshed me and kind of got me back to realize, okay, that's really what I fell in love with the wine business for, is this lifestyle, this passion, this connection to the earth. And I saw it there and I experienced it for 3 months. And it allowed me to come back to Napa saying, okay, I kind of know what I want to get out of my career in the wine industry now a little bit more than I did previous to that.
So you're back here in the States.
It seemed very serendipitous, but I got back about a month before escrow was closing on this property, Terra Valentine. And my dad was working with his childhood friend, Dennis Fife. And Dennis had formed a partnership with Angus Wirtle to lease this facility on this property and make the Fife wines and the Terra Valentine wines here under a joint venture. And so they hired my father as the consulting winemaker to help put the winery facility together. And then my dad was responsible for getting a crew together to operate the cellar. And so I was living at home, needed a job, just returned from Australia. And so I was hired as the cellar master here. And then we had two other guys, you know, that helped out. And so we started here in July of 1999, which was right after escrow closed. And that started my 10-year career at Terra Valentine.
So when did you officially take over as winemaker?
I took over as winemaker in the summer of 2002. So the 2002 was vintage was my first full vintage as winemaker.
How did that feel, your first vintage that was yours?
The first few vintages, you know, working with my dad, you know, we learned a lot from each other. And I was always very eager to take over the reins. You know, it was something I was just, okay, I'm ready to do this. And when it finally happened and it was, you know, primarily up to me to make these decisions, it was somewhat intimidating initially. I mean, I just turned 25, so I was, you know, fairly young to be taking over the reins of this operation. But, you know, I had a good support network, and I think that was something that Angus Wirtle really saw and kind of helped put into place, was the fact my dad was still, you know, he was still here as the general manager. And so I was set up to succeed, really, and not push too far, but given all the right tools, the right vineyards, all the tricky work had been done. So all I had to do really was just trust my instinct and run with it.
You're making it, Sam, you're making it sound like it was easy, but I'm sure it couldn't have been anywhere near that.
Well, I mean, when anything's as fun as this is, it kind of is easy to a certain extent. I mean, it's the hardest thing that I'll do in my career, but it's easy because it's fun. I enjoy it. So it comes naturally.
That's great. And with any luck, maybe your kids will follow in your path then, right?
You never know. My dad was always lobbied us to either become an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor. He's figured the family could use one of those for sure. But my brother and I became winemakers, so what are you going to do?
Where's your brother a winemaker?
He and my dad have a small winery up in Anderson Valley called Baxter Winery. So they're up on the coastal ridge between Philo and Elk, which is about 1,600 feet in elevation, and have a little winery and making single vineyard Pinots and Zins. There are less than 2,000 cases. Some vintages less than 1,000 cases. So.
And what is Terra Valentine doing right now in terms of production?
We're right around 10,000 cases. And most of that is consists of our estate Cabernets, our Spring Mountain Cab, and our two single vineyards, the Wortle Vineyard and Yverdon Vineyard. And then we make some other wines that we source the fruit from and are kind of make some fun blends.
Primarily, though, is what we're seeing mostly up here in terms of the vineyards?
We've got two different estates on Spring Mountain. The Wortle Vineyard estate is located down at about 1,000 feet in elevation, so it's on a separate property. That vineyard is 35 acres of Cabernet that was planted back in 1990, so it's a fairly mature vineyard. The Wortles bought that in 1995, and so it was their first venture into Napa from Minnesota, and they then bought this property in 1999, and we subsequently, starting in 2001, planted about 25 acres of vineyard up here, some of which the last acreage is not even producing yet, so they're fairly young vines.
About how many years ago was that?
We finished planting last year, the last couple blocks, but most of it was planted in 2001 and 2006, so most of it's in production right now.
We interviewed Charlie Smith over at Smith Padrone.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah, they've been on the mountain for quite a while.
They have had some problems with phylloxera. Have you run into that at all?
We have. We've got phylloxera down at the Wortle Vineyard. That vineyard was planted right after the failure of the AXR1 rootstock. So when they planted that vineyard, they already knew that they couldn't use AXR1. So there's really only one choice. There are a couple of choices, but one of the most popular choices at the time was the Freedom rootstock. And so they planted that entire vineyard on Freedom rootstock. This rootstock was originally designed for its nematode resistance on sandy soils. So it's perfect if you've got a Thompson seedless vineyard down in Bakersfield on sandy soil. Those roots can get down, they find the water, they're very vigorous. But you throw them on volcanic clay soil on a cooler exposure in Napa, and these vines wanted to grow. I mean, they were some monster vines. When we came in 1999, it was a jungle. And we whipped it into shape, but now, you know, that the vines are mature and we've got them balanced and they're doing a good job, we're finding that the Freedom rootstock is actually pretty resistant to phylloxera. And in some instances, I know this sounds kind of strange, I feel like there's a kind of a symbiosis going on between the phylloxera and the rootstock, and the phylloxera is actually keeping the rootstock in check so that the yields are more reasonable, and actually some of the blocks where we have the most phylloxera are highest quality blocks. At some point, you know, it'll kill the vine, but for now, it's probably doing good things for the quality and reducing the vigor of that rootstock.
Yeah, I've never heard that before, but if it's working for you, right?
Right. The main thing with phylloxera is as long as they can't do too much damage to the roots and really kill the vines. So these roots, the phylloxera will feed on them, but it doesn't damage them, and they can continue to grow. And so they are resistant to phylloxera, but a little bit of phylloxera kind of just keeps the vines in check a little bit.
What is your distribution for Terra Valentine?
We distribute primarily our three estate Cabernets. In fact, exclusively our three estate Cabernets throughout the country. So we use a national marketing company called the San Francisco Wine Exchange, which acts as a nationwide broker for our wines. So they are interface between distributors in various markets. Because of that, you know, broad network, we are in about 40 different states. But again, you know, our main wine that we sell is our Spring Mountain District Cabernet. So it's our one estate blend of our two vineyards. And that is pretty widely distributed. You can find in most states, or at least it's available. So then in 2003, we finished the winery and opened up a tasting room. And at that point, we realized that we wanted to make some wines that were more exclusive to our mailing list, wine club, and to our tasting room program. And so I would say about 25% of our volume is in wine that's only sold here or through our mailing list.
And obviously then everything is done by appointment. It's somewhat of a private tasting situation.
Correct. And that's primarily determined by the county regulations. So because we were this old winery, we potentially had some options to be full open to the public, you know, picnic tables and the whole bit. But in order to kind of keep the peace on the mountain and keep the feel of the small winery, not have busloads of tourists coming up here, we opted to kind of take the more private approach.
Do you have any opinion between corks or caps?
I like corks a lot. I love popping a cork on a big red that's been laid down. I like the way the wine ages under cork. There's no question about that. I am frustrated by cork taint in wines. I think it's a little bit insane that we have to put a closure onto our wines that we know there's maybe a 5 to 10% chance that it's going to spoil that product. So that's tough. I think the cork industry has come a long way in improving that. That said, I like screw caps on certain wines. In 2005, we switched over to bottling all of our whites on screw cap and keeping our reds under cork. And I really like the way that works. I like being able to, unscrew the white wine, pour a glass, screw it back in, throw it in the fridge again. It works for that. I think it keeps it clean. I haven't had any issues with sulfides I think that is complete propaganda. If you make a terrible wine with sulfides and put anything in it, you're going to have sulfides in it. So if you make a clean wine, then you have nothing to worry about. This past year, with the 2008 vintage, we were bottling our first estate-grown Riesling, which is the first estate white we've ever produced. And so I wanted to do something a little different with that. And so I used one of the glass closures. And so far, that has its drawbacks as well. But I think the consumers that I've talked to really think that that's something neat. They think it's a very fancy type of a closure. I kind of liken it to a perfume bottle. It has that same sort of elegance to it. So I like that. I think it's expensive and it has some drawbacks.
What drawbacks would you say the glass has?
I'd say the main drawback that I've experienced is in applying that closure. And I'm not sure if there's equipment that can do a better job at it. But with our equipment existing here on our mobile bottling line that we use, we have to apply them by hand. So as they go through, we throw them on. The corker kind of pushes them down, and then the capsule spins on top of it. But there's no vacuum pulled on the wine. And I think in the long run, that's a real weakness that's going to have to be addressed by either having a special machine that is brought in to apply those under vacuum. So I'd say at this point, that's my biggest complaint with the glass closures, because I feel like there's a little silicone bead that seats the closure. And when you just put it in, before that silicone has a time to really adhere and mold to the bottle, we maybe 1 out of 5 would kind of jump right out of the bottle because they're so springy. And then for the first week or so, if you opened one, some of them, you'd take the capsule off and they would pop out of the bottle. And I think when the wine warms up and expands in volume a little bit, we've had a couple that would leak easier than I think they would if there's a vacuum pulled on there. So there's a work in progress, but for us, it's a really nice closure.
Do you see that maybe the compromise would be with time where reds will stay in America anyway with corks and maybe whites will go completely over to screw caps?
I think you'll continue to see that trend happening. There will always be some whites that will stay in cork, and especially as you get into more expensive Chardonnays, there's going to be a resistance to that still. But I think I don't think we're going to see reds go away from cork. I mean, I really don't think that in wine, over $30, I think that's going to stay in cork for a long time.
This is really an amazing building, very castle-like. Can you tell me about that and the property?
This property has a really interesting history. It was built by a guy named Fred Aves, who was an inventor back in the 50s, and he invented a couple of automotive parts, such as the adjustable side view mirror. It's a little joystick in the dashboard that would move your mirror. Also, the curb feelers for cars, you know, those little, those sticks that would stick out to protect your white wall tires, and then the chrome plated license plate frame as well. So he was this really eccentric guy, moved up here in 1965 and designed and engineered this building and built it all himself. He and his son, and they split all the rocks. He made all the stained glass windows. They actually poured made the cement on site. That he bought an old batch plant and actually made his cement up here. So there was no contractors, no engineering plans, no building permits. Just built this winery out in the middle of the woods and named it Yverdon, Yverdon. And this was a town in Switzerland where his family had a winery back in the 1860s. And so he wanted to kind of associate, this would be the Yverdon of California to a certain extent. He made some really nice wines. Tom Cottrell was one of his winemakers. Kathy Corson actually got her start here in the late 70s. And then one day in the early 80s, Fred came in and shut the winery down and said, I'm closing down the winery. Subsequently tore out all the vineyards on the property and lived the last 15 years as a recluse. And when he finally passed away in 97, he gave all of his estate, this property, the vineyard in Calistoga, and numerous other holdings all to charity. And that's how the Wirtles were able to buy it through the trustees of Bank of America. So it's got a real unique history. And it's one of the newer wineries post-Prohibition, so one of the first wineries that was built up here post-Prohibition. I grew up right at the base of Spring Mountain in St. Helena. And so, you know, I spent my childhood kind of hiking through these hills. And, you know, it's a really unique part of the Napa Valley. Here in Spring Mountain, we've got the most subtypes of soil within any AVA in Napa Valley. So we've got a mixture of sedimentary soils and volcanic soils. And it's a real patchwork. And I think that is one of the factors that adds to the overall complexity of the wines coming from this area. You know, then you have the climate, and being on the western side of Napa, you know, right over the ridgetop here into Sonoma County, you drop right down in the Russian River. So we get a pretty strong coastal influence here, much moister, more rainfall in the winter. But we get a really unique climate during the growing season especially. So when the fog fills up the valley floor at night, it pushes all that warm air up into the hilltops. So when the sun rises here, we'll be at 70, 75 degrees, and the vines are ripening. They get a ton of morning sun, midday sun as well. And then, you know, later in the afternoon, around 4 or 5, the sun starts to go down a little bit, and we start to get that cooling breeze that comes up over from Russian River up over the ridgetop and really cools off the higher elevation. So we'll be maybe 10 degrees cooler than the valley floor in the afternoon. And I think it protects these really elegant characters that you get in the fruit, these aromatic, these unique, like this chocolate character, this black licorice, some of these things that come out from being in that cooler climate. And then you have the personalities on Spring Mountain, all these, you know, small family-owned, iconoclastic individuals that are taking their soil, their little microclimate, and making their style of wine out of it. So the quality level overall is exceptionally high for an AVA because everyone is so committed to that. But then you have such a range of character in the wines and in the personalities behind them. So it's a really, I think, a unique slice of Napa Valley that's very different than certainly the valley floor and other mountain appellations.
Sam, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us about Terra Valentine.
Well, no, thanks. Appreciate you coming up and seeing Spring Mountain.
I'd love to taste your wine.
Okay, let's do it.
Great.
You can find Terra Valentine wines on the web at terravalentine.com.